Good morning. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. Chris Anderson, former editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, has just released his newest book, Makers, The New Industrial Revolution. He's on the money with Chris DeSimeo.
Good morning. Just imagine if you were given the gift of being allowed to peer into the future, if you could somehow just pull back the curtains and have what was to come just laid out for you. For example, if you had been hanging around in a garage in California about 35 years ago and decided to join the homebrew computer club, what would you have done with that information? If you were there at the beginning of the indie rock movement, how could that have made money for you? And certainly, if you were around in the early 90s and were working someplace where things were starting to get connected together, how would that have changed the way you invest? Well, the answers are all in a brand new book, available online and at your favorite bookstore. The book is called Makers, The New Industrial Revolution, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the show Chris Anderson. Chris is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. He also, of course, has written The Long Tail. These are New York Times bestsellers, The Future of a Radical Price, and also Free is The Future of a Radical Price, and also The Long Tail. And Chris, thanks so much for taking part of your weekend to be with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Chris, define for us for a moment the maker movement. What exactly is it?
Well, the maker movement is the web generation meets the real world. It's what happens when, just as the personal computer gave us all the ability to have access to desktop computers, and then the web gave us access to communications, this is a new generation of tools that give us access to manufacturing, 3D printers and laser cutters and things like that. And as a result, we can combine everything we've been doing for the last 20 years on the web in terms of community and working together with these tools to do with physical things what we've been doing on screen.
You describe it in your book, Makers, as the kind of tug of war between bits and atoms, and point out, among many startling things that you point out in your book, is that there actually is a part of MIT called the MIT Project for Bits and Atoms?
A center for bits and atoms, yeah. I mean, this is really the distinction between, the virtual and the physical world. And, bits are amazing. Digital information is amazing because it can be, replicated and transmitted at no cost. We could make an infinite number of copies, everything else that created the web. But physical stuff typically doesn't obey those properties. It's it costs money to make, and it's hard to transport. What's happened, though, is that now we're describing physical stuff with digital information, digital designs. And what we're doing in the maker movement is basically starting, inventing things and conceiving them on screen using software programs. It's called CAD programs that are increasingly free and easy. And then just sharing these designs in communities and online, as we do with on the web, allowing then people to fabricate them on their desktop.
You describe the three characteristics of the maker movement, the DIY network, the cultural norm, and the common design files. Could you just take a few minutes and explain what those three pillars are of this movement?
Sure. Well, it's based on the notion that we're all makers at heart. We're born makers, children playing with blocks and painting. And if you cook, you like to cook, you're essentially making in the kitchen. If you like to garden, you're making out back. But over time we often either keep that just a hobby, or we lose it entirely because it doesn't seem like we're going anywhere. It really is very personal. Maybe we don't have the skills to do anything more exotic. That's all changing thanks to the web's norms. The second factor is that the web is essentially a culture of sharing. If you do something, videotape it. If you videotape it, post it on YouTube. If you post on YouTube and people comment, respond, etc. Actually, I'm not sure you want to respond to YouTube comments, but in most other, most other web communities, there is a kind of a general default towards sharing things and building on each other's work. The third thing is that because of these digital tools that we've been talking about, we now have a common language for design that's accessible to everybody. I mentioned these CAD files, but basically we have a way to collaborate and work together on physical things the way we did on things like open source software, Linux, Firefox, and the like. We can now do that with design files for anything as simple as a cup or as complex as a car.
Hey, Chris, at the beginning of your book, you use the example of your grandfather who worked in the movie business out in Southern California, and you describe your visits out there as a child from the East. It must have seemed magical, and yet he was an inveterate tinkerer. And you describe the differences between how he came up with an idea, which are theoretically infinite, as you point out in the book, as opposed to stuff, which has a limit somewhere, and the difference between how he did it 60 years ago or 50 years ago and how he would have done it today. Can we get to the Cliff Notes version of that?
Sure. Well, the idea was the automatic sprinkler system, which was, he was a Swiss engineer, which meant he was a bit of a watchmaker, and he recognized that, you know, all those sprinklers were great. You had to turn them on and off, and if you could just put a little watch or clock on top of that, you'd have an automatic one. That's what he invented. And he sketched it out on paper, as one did in those days. He then had a workshop, and in that workshop, he was able to prototype it with things like a metal lathe, and he was basically not just an inventor, but he was also a machinist, which is an important distinction. Today, I couldn't do that because I may have had ideas, but I wasn't a machinist. I didn't have a way to prototype them.
Right.
Now I do. I have a 3D printer or access to these digital design tools, fabrication tools, and so I could make that leap. So I thought it'd be, you know, interesting just to, how would Grandpa invent, you know, the automatic sprinkler system today? And basically, it would be based, it would be electronic. It would be based on an open, hardware platform like Arduino. And it would be connected to the web, and anybody could add sensors, and it would be free, you know, at least the service would be free, et cetera. So I just did it. I know nothing about sprinklers, but in a matter of about a month, I was able to kind of work together with people and come up with something we called Open Sprinkler, which is basically part of the so-called Internet of Things. And get into production and put it out there. And again, we know nothing about this subject, but it became so easy to do that as almost a proof of concept.
The difference in cost, your grandfather had his idea, then he couldn't make it at any kind of scale, as you point out. So he had to hire someone to manufacture it. And before he did that, he had to hire patent attorneys. The whole thing must have cost a fortune back then. What did it cost for you to go from the idea to being on the web and live doing business in your recreation of what your grandfather did?
A couple thousand dollars, credit card limit, small
wow.
credit card limit.
Wow. So when you described that, what really struck me was the idea that we hear this all the time, someone has an idea, and yet they're so protective of it that they don't want to share it until they get it patented. And that's where you run into bogging down time-wise and you incur a lot of cost. What are the advantages of giving this away free?
You know, that is one of the more counterintuitive elements for people who aren't sort of, who haven't kind of grown up in the open source world online. In the book, I talk about my own experience as a maker, which began in robotics and ended up with a drone company. We are, as a matter of fact, I'm actually leaving Wired to become CEO of this company. It's gotten, you know, big enough. Yeah. We're an open source hardware company, which is to say we give away all of our intellectual property, our design files, our code, and everything. And we, not only that, but we license it under terms that people can make it and sell it and compete against us. Why would we do that? And the answer is we have 20 years of experience with open source software that shows us that, you know, if you give away a little, you get back more in return. What it does is it turns your customers into contributors because, you know, not all of them are going to, you know, have the skills or inclination to add something, but some of them will. Let's say just 1% of them do. What you've done is you've made it easier for them to do it. You've done most of the work, and they don't have to reinvent the wheel. They can just add a feature to what you've already done, or fix a bug, or improve the documentation, maybe just help another user. And all those elements of contribution, which are super important, are things that are being driven by social and, you know, personal incentives rather than money. So what you end up with is basically a huge and free R&D. Machine that's working for you, often paying you for the products and then contributing back to the project simply because you made the choice of giving away your IP. Will people compete against you? Will people take your ideas? Absolutely. But because you have this superior innovation engine, you should be able to outcompete them by just kind of creating new versions faster.
Fascinating stuff. It is a peek into the future and should be on the holiday list for anyone who's interested in making things and also in the world of money. The book is Makers, the author Chris Anderson. I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimio on The Money.